The following program is pre-recorded.
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Jim Sullivan was an entertainer. He was married and he had a young son. He left California for Nashville. Jim had $120 in his pocket and he drove straight from California to Santa Rosa, New Mexico. On a March day in 1975, Sullivan took his VW and drove away from Santa Rosa after spending the night out into the desert, and he disappeared forever. Days later, after he was reported missing, police found his car. It was abandoned in the middle of nowhere. Inside his car was his guitar, wallet, luggage, and date books. Also, there were a few copies of his latest release, UFO.
Shaking like a leaf on a desert heat. His daddy's got a bang that's so hard to beat. I bought me a ticket, got a front row seat. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye, looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Did he come by UFO?
Did he come? Jim Sullivan. A lot of people think perhaps he was abducted. Did he have a meeting with the ETs? Strange things happen in New Mexico. New Mexico has probably more stories about UFOs and high strangeness than any state in the Union. As you know, we do a lot of shows from New Mexico. We're going to do a show tonight on this program that is really, truly groundbreaking. The old term breaking news is for sure on this story that Paula Harris has come forward with. We'll be talking to two witnesses who were young boys in New Mexico when they witnessed a UFO crash, even saw the ETs inside the craft. It happened in 1945. That's right, almost 2 years before Roswell. We'll get into all of that, but first of all, let's welcome Paula Harris to the show. And Paula, you've been hanging around Boulder. You've not been moving around
much.
Yes,
I just finished my fourth book, and I had to stay put.
Paula, I don't think we can overstate the story. You've really come up with what I would consider the story of the century. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit of how this came about, how you got into this.
Pretty impressed, too, Jerry. This is probably the second biggest story I've covered. The first one was Colonel Philip Corso. And, you know, that was the Roswell anniversary of 1997. And he for me, changed the whole, sense of ufology because he talked about the back engineering of alien technology. Well, you know, this is the second one, and it's another New Mexico-type situation. It's a crash that happened in 1945, 2 months after the atomic bomb testing on the Trinity site. And, of course, you know, people look at San Antonio, and it's not San Antonio, Texas. It's San Antonio, New Mexico. Realize that it's very close to the Trinity site, to ground zero. Something or somebody was watching all of that, and because of the intervention of two little Hispanic boys that lived in that area, we have another eyewitness account of a UFO crash. And the amazing part about this, Jerry, is they not only saw the craft crash, they walked up to it. They were about 200 yards away from it, and they saw the beings inside. And to add to this, one of the little boys, the older one, Jose Padilla, 9 years old, when he sees that the craft is unattended on a flatbed truck, runs up to the flatbed, opens up the tarp, and goes inside the craft and pulls off.
Paula, I talked to both of them, Jose and Remy, and we recorded the conversations. And let's play right here, right now, them talking about how they got this piece of the UFO.
Listen. At one time, we sneaked out, Remy and I sneaked out there on the horses again to go and wash. And they had five men imposed there, five soldiers imposed there. One of them was imposed, and the four were working on that craft. Trying to fix up, they built an L-frame to set up on a lowboy trailer to hold it away. And they worked on that for almost a week. But we used to go there a little late in the evening and watch from top of the hill. And I noticed that four of them used to get on their jeep and go and take off to a bar that used to be called, still the Avo Bar and Cafe, to have fun out there. And one of them used to stand poster. And it happened that they had loaded this piece of crap, you know, on a lowboy trailer. That last day that they were there, I remember, it was a Saturday. And we stayed there a little later than usual. And I noticed that all five soldiers jumped in the jeep and took off to the bar. At that time, we waited about 30 minutes. We hopped on our horses and ran down to where the trailer was. And they had a tarp over it tied down. Remy went on ahead and untied the rope from the tarp. And I hopped in that trailer and went in through that hole.
What did you see in there?
Nothing. It was clear, except for one thing that was in there. There was a panel. There was this piece of material that like a handle that I tried to yank it out, and I couldn't. So I jumped off the trailer and went over and got a bar. They call a cheater bar that they tied the chains on a trailer. I went over and stuck that bar underneath there and ripped that thing right off.
How big of a piece was it?
Oh, but 14 inches long.
What do you think it was used for?
At that time and at times and now, I think how it was mounted on that panel, it was like a radar mechanism that they would operate with to handle that sheep.
Jose Padillo in California and Remy Baca up in Washington State at Gig Harbor. Paula, you actually spent some time at Remy's. That's a strange name.
Remy, Remigo, and it's short is Remy. He moved away later on in life, went up to Washington State, and he probably will tell you he spent a lot of time in Washington State politics, and he couldn't talk about this story for many years. His wife is Roman Catholic and did not believe in UFOs and thought they shouldn't touch it. Until they had a sighting in 1994, and then his wife became a believer. She, you know, she saw the UFO over their house. In my interview with her, she talks about being emotionally, connected, and that she started to cry because it was such a shocker. The craft was right over their house at a very low altitude, and that helped her with this. Digest this whole phenomenon, and it was then that Remy could talk about it in a public format. And of course, he had already talked to Jose Padilla. They had found each other after many years, and they both had made a decision to come public.
Yeah, but we mentioned you went up to Gig Harbor.
I happened to be in Washington State for the East SETI conference, the James Gilliland situation, and I just went up to Gig Harbor from there. But I wanted to tell you that, the way I got the story was another man had contacted me because he had written to me and on Internet and told me that his father was the pilot that flew the bodies out of the 1945 crash. And then I began to ask, well, what crash in 1945? And this person sent me his father's documents, his father's picture, and then gave me the telephone number of Remy Baca. And that's how I got in touch with him. You know, I said, is this true? Was there something in 1945? And then he talked to me for a long period of time. He began to trust me, and we made a decision that we would work together to release the story.
Paula, do you mind if we get back to the core story and pick it up where Jose and Remy saw the ETs and the crash?
No. What Remy and Jose saw after the dust cleared, because they saw there was a big storm in New Mexico. I hope they talk about this, because we have the lightning storm. It also happened during the Roswell crash.
That's one of the first things I noticed about this story that really got my attention. It caught my attention.
Yeah, it caught mine too, because I know that's a problem. It interferes with the navigation system of these craft. And there was also a radar tower there, really close. So whatever happened that caused this avocado-shaped round craft to crash is very, very important. And then the two little boys slowly walked up to it, you know, and with binoculars looked inside and saw three creatures that Remy describes as floating instead of walking, back and forth. They looked like they were floating.
August 16th, 1945, when Remy and I mounted two horses, and we ran into a heavy thunderstorm. So we dodged down underneath some rocks, and we heard a sonic boom. And I looked back at him, and I said, there must be another bomb test, you know, just because a month before that, they had just tested that first atomic bomb. July 16th.
I asked them if they heard an engine noise or anything, and Remy and actually Jose replied that, well, listen.
No, it's just like a sonic boom and like a lot of metal scraping the ground. We mounted the horses again, and we seen some smoke coming out of the other ridge, and so we mounted the horses. We went over the hill and came out on the other side, and we seen this big object. The ground was smoking, which were burning. We stopped there. A wedge on the ground cut sideways. I have a feeling that there used to be a tower, some kind of a radio tower at Italian Peak, which is about 3 miles north from there. I believe that lightning was the one who contacted that, and they hit the tower, you know, and this one made the big hole in the side. We got down to about almost, probably about a football field long, 210 yards probably, except that it was so hot there, you know, and smoky that we could hardly see much. We've seen, with the binoculars, I seen inside there, three young men, you know, creatures, just walking back and forth real fast, squeaking, sashaying from one end to the other. What we could see through that hole, you know. They look like a, because we were young kids then, they look like a red ant standing up, with kampamocha. I don't know if you ever heard that word.
Kampamocha is a like a praying mantis, big eyes, you know. Yeah.
So they were insect-like.
Well, the head was.
The head looked like that.
So as you heard there, Paula, they seem to think that the UFO hit the tower rather than the lightning bringing it down. However, I've heard that the radar itself was used as a weapon, you know, affecting the avionics and knocking these UFOs out of the sky. Have you ever heard that story?
Well, I haven't heard that, but I did hear that it was very dangerous for these craft, and that Colonel Corso, when he was head of the missile battalion in Red Canyon, was asked to shut his radars down during certain times of the day. And to shut them down meant because they were having problems. That's when he had his sighting, when he didn't shut it down one time, and then he had that contact experience.
Paula, let's mention again the location. This Padillo Ranch was close to White Sands Missile Base, And actually very close to where they tested the atomic bomb.
Because they'll, if you ask them, they'll tell you how they lived through the bomb blast. I mean, I think it was Rennie whose bed went from one side of the room to the other. And I think it was Jose whose mother was half blinded by the...
Yeah, she was looking out the door and the flash came off and injured her eye, actually blinded her.
And they didn't tell him that's what was happening. They made up another story. About the proof.
I mean, years later, they still weren't admitting it was an atomic blast. They were saying it was an ammo dump.
So they never told the inhabitants how
I'm truly surprised these two guys are still here. I mean, that place had to be covered with radiation.
And they said at that time that San Antonio, the city, had a very small population. I don't know, you know, exactly 300 or something. So it's a very small town.
Paula Harris is our guest, and Paula, we've had the prelude kind of set up the show. Next, we're going to get into the body of the program and really cover some of the details. That's coming up next on the Jerry Pippin Show. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found it. Although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road, and I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking. So well researched, Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. Now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. It happened in the late afternoon. A very heavy thunderstorm pounded the mesquite and greasewood-covered desert west of old U.S. 85. This is where now Milepost 130 is located, the San Antonio exit on Interstate 25. It was a far different time in that part of New Mexico from what it is now. The Patello Ranch, isolated and close to the White Sands testing ground, which sprawled out like a giant tarantula in the desert, holding secrets that still exist today, somewhere deep in the archives of the Pentagon. No one knew, except for the Army, which launched a recovery operation looking for the crashed UFO. At least that's what the officials thought at the time, but no one knew but them. But there were two small boys, 1-7 and 1-9, Remy Baca and Jose Padilla. They watched from a nearby hill. They had seen the crash of the craft up close and personal. They even saw what was inside, something these boys kept to themselves for decades. Extraterrestrial creatures with big eyes, and they were squealing in pain like injured jackrabbits in the desert. However, there's more to the story, and we have investigative reporter Paula Harris with us. She's on the line from Boulder, Colorado. Paula, this story with these two men now in their 70s certainly backs up the idea that UFOs have been investigating nuclear activities by the United States and other countries for some time, all the way back to World War II. You know quite a lot about this story. You even spent some time up in Gig Harbor, Washington with one of the men, Remy. I mean, you even had that mile marker location down pat.
Yeah, near there. But the I think they have 180,000 acres on that ranch. You know, so it isn't, like, easy to find. The thing is, too, that they were thinking, you know, even in the future, to get involved with the city of Socorro, New Mexico, and have, you know, maybe the piece that they took in a museum there, or have this story planted there in Socorro, so that people all over the world, and kids, and you know, people that are interested could have a place to go to look at this.
You know, Paula, this entire area of New Mexico is full of UFO stories. I mean, you know, have you heard about Lonnie Zamora, the the police officer who saw the Sikora UFO? I'm sure you have. And that's not very far
from
there.
That's right. You need to ask Grummy about that because they knew who Zamora was. And I think that you had even talked to him because this is all connected to that. So if people were doing their homework, they would connect the dots down there about what it was. The sheriff's name was Eddie Apodaca, and he, I think, was also connected with that case. So, you know, we need to know who knew whom and the dates of when all of this happened and so forth.
Well, one of the things about this story is the fact that all the way back to 1945, there's evidence of UFOs prying around the area where we were developing nuclear weapons. Later on, this was carried out in nuclear silos, missile bases, all kinds of stories about that. Seems to be an ET UFO nuclear connection, don't you think?
Yeah, and it came from a letter that Einstein and Oppenheimer wrote to President Truman. It's one of the Majestic 12 documents. I can send it to you if you want to. Where in June of 1947, Einstein and Oppenheimer said there was too much activity in that site, the Trinity site, and that they had had so many sightings that they had come to the conclusion that we were being visited by extraterrestrial cultures, and what were we going to do about it? That they had opened Pandora's box, and that they wanted a structure, a super United Nations, to deal with this. And this letter was sent to it was drafted, and Vannevar Bush canceled it out, said it would never go to Truman. And, of course, you know he was one of the Majestic 12 people. But why would Oppenheimer and Einstein try to address all of these sightings? Plus, they use the word extraterrestrial biological entity in the letters, in these documents. Why did they use that when Roswell had not happened yet? This document is dated in June of 1947.
Now this particular sighting happened in August of 1945. Roswell happened in 1947 in July, 1 year, 11 months later. Seems to be a connection.
That's right. But I'm beginning to wonder how many other crashes happened before Roswell. Remy is very clear when he says the crew that cleaned up this particular crash was inexperienced because they were throwing pieces in a trench, and they were not wearing hazmat suits. They were not worried about radiation. Why would they go to the Owl Cafe and leave unattended this craft? I mean, there was not the meticulous cleaning up that was done for Roswell. So I think this is one of the first crashes ever in that area.
I assume this crash was under the control of the White Sands missile people. And that's interesting, Paula, how they handled it is different from Roswell. Roswell released a press release right away bragging about it. White Sands used to secrecy, of course, didn't mention it.
White Sands, right. It was the same guys that were there.
I wonder if those soldiers told anybody at that cafe, that bar, about what they were doing. Small town, you know, people were curious.
Well, I don't know, but that same cafe is where Oppenheimer used to. See, this is why I believe the Oppenheimer-Einstein letter, because that's the same cafe that he used to go to when he was, you know, there were very few watering holes there in that area. There's nothing there. And so that was the only place people met. And apart from being a bar, it was a cafe and a food place. So, you know, this is 1945. They just, nobody went by there. And if it wasn't for these two little boys who told their father, the Padilla father, that about what happened, then we wouldn't have even had this story.
Interestingly enough, this was actually a story that was printed in the Sikora, New Mexico newspaper several years ago by Ben Moffat, I think, was the reporter.
Yeah, Mountain Mail paper, but then in addition, he was also a classmate of Remy's. So, you mean, they went to school together.
Yeah, is Ben Moffat still alive?
Yeah, he is. And I gave him credit when I did the interview for Coast, because he's the one that wrote the first story on it. And it was an amazingly good story that he wrote. It was in 2003, and that's what brought the story out. Now, because I'm not the first one to hear about this story. You know, other researchers that heard about it, Ryan Wood, has talked to them. It came up because it was written by Ben Moffitt. So we have a lot of real responsible journalists.
You would have thought that once that story was published, it would have skyrocketed around the world. But I hadn't heard about it until you brought it to my attention.
Gary, you know, I don't know how to say this, but it has to be one of us that takes this on. And because of my position internationally, I'm a very well-known international investigative journalist. I released it first in Italy. I mean, it's been written about on two issues of X Times magazine in Italy. And then I released it secondly in the UK with UFO Matrix with Philip Mantle and that group. And lastly, I released it in the United States on a big level, because somehow when things get out here, nobody covers them and nobody takes it seriously. And so if I can do anything at all, and like you're doing right now, to tell people this is a historical event, and it's real, and it happened, and we need to look at it, then you and I are doing the best we can to work in the United States on this.
Paula, when these two boys saw the ETs inside the craft, they were alive. Have you ever followed up or tried to follow up about what happened to the ETs? I mean, no, that's not an easy job. I mean,
it isn't. Either they have a recovery team of their own, the aliens, where they come and get their own people, or they were, you know, taken by the military, which I don't think happened, or they were loose in the desert, which I've heard of too, because in those days the ET, some of them alive, were found wandering around the desert. So, you know, all of, especially if they're connected with a ship, which Colonel Corso said they were. They were used to fly ship. They're extraterrestrial biological entities. I don't know. Nobody knows. And all that Remy and Jose can tell you is what they saw. They saw the beings, and they'll describe them for you.
Interesting. When I talked to Jose and Remy, they brought up the chance or the idea that the beings may have just left the craft and were wandering around in the desert.
Possibility. I've heard of that, too. I mean, that the beings are, you know, kind of, they probably could wander around the desert, or maybe they were recovered by their own.
Well, we make every effort to pick up our pilots and other people down in action. Why wouldn't the ETs?
That's true. That's absolutely true. All that Remy and Jose will tell you is the following recovery, period, that they didn't see them anymore. They weren't there.
Both Jose and Remy, I talked to them both, and they seem to have some strange reactions. Once they got close to the craft, after it crashed, and they saw the creatures inside, they described it as almost sadness, like at a funeral. And they both sensed that these creatures were hurting physically. And they had other things happening to them, at least mentally. Paula, I know you pretty well. I know you talked to both of them about this and how they felt about it and the emotions and everything involved.
How did you feel when he said, I felt panicking like they had been hurt or something? And he also got pictures in his mind. He had some kind of contact with these beings, because in his later life, he explains, he's writing a book, you know, I think it's called Born in Ground Zero, Living in the Shadow of Area 51. That's his book that he spent a lot of time writing. He talks about his ability to, his ESP ability later on in his life, and his ability to predict lottery numbers right up till the end, you know, and his ability to sense things. And this could have come from contact with these beings. You know, we have to look at this. Anybody that is in contact with ET beings has an enhanced ESP ability. And I had asked Remy in detail about that, and he had told me these incidences where this happened. Now, also, he and Ginny, Virginia, had that sighting in 1994, too, so maybe there was something from that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if that was connected.
Well, it wasn't the same kind of ship. What they saw in Washington State was a regular saucer-shaped craft, kind of round on the bottom, something like he said what was in Close Encounters. And what fell in San Antonio was an avocado-shaped craft. And you can ask Jose, who lives in California, about the top part of that. It had a little, he said, almost like a little a window part or a little observatory part on the top part of that avocado shape.
Paula, it's interesting. The Sikora craft, I think in 67, was described as egg-shaped. And that's not much different than an avocado. So maybe they're related. Maybe the same thing, same people, same ETs, same craft. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you know, that's an important setting. Is there anybody left from that particular case? Is there any? Are there any witnesses that are still alive from, you know, Lonnie Zmora had talked to?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. Ray Stanford's still around, and we have another show to do with him, and he was the premier investigator on that, the Sikora incident.
What if they're the same kind of group? They have the same kind of avocado-shaped craft, which is round.
I think Colonel Corso told you something interesting about who he thought were flying these things.
There was something going on that very interested an extraterrestrial race. And it didn't necessarily mean that who's inside the craft is who was interested, because Colonel Corso told me that what he believed was inside the craft were the navigators for the creators of those. In other words, they were supposed to report back that the creators of these beings were probably look like us.
Very, very interesting, Paula. You know, it suddenly occurred to me we really haven't plugged the books properly. So, Paula, it's your turn. Plug away, baby.
My book is called Exopolitics, Gateway to a New Reality, Stargate to a New Reality, and it has the 53-page interview with the witnesses of the 1945 crash, but it also has interviews with pilots, with Guy Kirkwood, with Milton Torres, with Jean-Jacques Dubac, the Cometa pilot, with pilots and military men who've given me other interviews. So the book is, like all my other books, filled with interviews.
Paula, you've known me, and I've known you for a long time. We've worked together on several projects. You're like me. You seem to be speeding up, doing more and more.
Well, they're coming to me. There's more and more stories. And you know why? I mean, I just talked to Don Schmidt about this. It's almost like the race with the Undertaker. People get to be a certain age. They get to be 70, 80 years old, and they decide they're going to talk. They decide before they pass on, they want to leave this for the history of humanity, what they lived through, and they are firsthand witnesses. And they're more important than me. I'm just a reporter. They're very important, and we must record this. So I have a real passion for recording this firsthand testimony, and like Schmidt and Carey do too, for a historical event. And that's what I believe.
Let's get back to this 1945 UFO crash for a moment. I know you're going to make a presentation there in Phoenix about it, and the book will be available. This is just a shocking story. I don't know any other word to use.
Yeah, I was in shock, Jerry, because they're telling the truth, and I'm thinking, what's going on here? Like, what's happening? We have a crash that we have, not only the witnesses to the crash, but one of the little boys goes aboard the craft. And, you know, why there? Why, you know, how come this hasn't been talked about before? Certainly there must have been some military people. And you know, I'm hoping they're going to come out of the woodwork, and the people that were involved with this, we'll have more witnesses. Because when we cover a story like this, what happens is, people finally decide to talk. But as Rummy said, they're going to be in their 90s or 80s, because these guys are 74 years old. And if you were in the military, you had to be at least 20 years older. So that puts you almost 90.
As we've noted on the air many times about these New Mexico UFO crashes, Unfortunately, the Undertaker is winning. Many of the witnesses are now gone.
It's a race, yeah. It's a race to get the real people. And, you know, they all take an oath. I mean, even the boys, you know, we're told by the military, don't talk about this. And we're not discussing. But they told Jose's father that it was a weather balloon. Because, and I hope Jose talks about this, they asked permission to cut the gate because they couldn't get the flatbed out to carry the weather balloon out. So, you know, that's a
pretty... Well, the old weather balloon story raises its head again. It was before Roswell, and the story is still going on.
Weather balloons everywhere. They were going to cut this guy's gate. He has a farm, you know.
Uh-huh.
They asked permission to put a new gate on there to do all this altering. It's not their property where this thing fell. And, you know, so they had to do... The cover-up started then, but I'm not sure who was in charge in 1945.
Well, I understand.
And, but I do think, and if somebody asked me about this, because of Oppenheimer, Einstein, Oppenheimer, even Wernher von Braun, you know, I've been talking to Carol Rosen about this. You know, he knew. They knew about this kind of stuff. Wernher von Braun told Clark McClellan that he had been to Roswell and had seen the bodies. Yeah, here's a paperclip scientist who, I mean, God knows what all happened in Germany, whether there were crashes there.
I guess there's lots of reasons why we're not going to get disclosure, or it doesn't appear that we will. Paula, patents, for one thing, back engineering, everything given to private enterprise. That could be challenged.
Well, that's part of it. But you know that these craft do not use gas and oil. They do not. It's a free energy discussion, and I don't think maybe the world is ready to embrace a new kind of paradigm right now. And if these things have been back engineered, they have been back engineered without the use of fossil fuels, and we've got an economy that's based on a lot of things that could possibly, you know, just fall and crash if the truth were to come out. The other reason, they started lying a long time ago. They're going to have to admit they lied. Can you see the Air Force saying, Roswell really did happen, we lied five times with five different excuses? No, they can't do that. I don't think that's something they're going to do. I don't know how this would ever come out. I certainly don't think any president's going to announce it.
Paula, I think that's a good way to leave it. Food for thought. Thanks for being on and telling us about the 1945 UFO crash in New Mexico.
Thank you, Jerry.
Talk to you again soon.